Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast, Rudy Giuliani Rampage Edition. I'm Galen Drucker. Here with me are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
Hey, is this an emergency podcast?
It's Galen, like a planned emergency.
A planned emergency.
Yeah, I think we decided yesterday that things had gotten out of hand enough.
Too much news. We had to...
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a Rampage podcast. Claire Malone, Senior Politics Writer. How's it going?
Good, Galen.
And here with us, special guests, we have Rick Pildes, constitutional law professor at New York University. How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
And you're in studio with us. Thanks for making the trek up from NYU.
I'm happy to be here.
So, President Trump hired former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani to his legal team last month, but he really made his debut this week. It started on Wednesday night when Giuliani seemingly contradicted Trump's previous comments that he didn't know about a $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. That, of course, was the payment that Michael Cohen made to Daniels as part of an agreement not to speak about an alleged affair between her and Trump. And it continued from there. Thursday and then Friday. And as we speak right now, we're kind of waiting for a statement from Rudy Giuliani, apparently that's going to correct some of the things that he said during the past few days. So by the time you listen to this, you may have those corrections, but
we don't.
Yeah. What he said. So we'll work off of that and then we can maybe adjust later. Anyway, we want to go through Giuliani's new comments and understand if they change things legally for Trump. And then we also want to talk more generally about where the investigation into Michael Cohen is headed. What are maybe the worst and best case scenarios for Trump? But let's begin with Wednesday night. Rudy Giuliani was on Sean Hannity. We have the audio. It's a minute long, so bear with us, but there's plenty of information to dissect in there. So here you go.
That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation.
So they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through a law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know he did.
Yeah.
There's no campaign finance law.
Zero.
So the president...
Just like every... Sean...
So this decision was made by...
Everybody was nervous about this from the very beginning. I wasn't. I knew how much money Donald Trump put into that campaign. I said, $130,000. He's going to do a couple of checks for $130,000. When I heard Cohen's retainer of $35,000, when he was doing no work for the president, I said, but that's how he's repaying. That's how he's repaying it, with a little profit and a little margin for paying taxes for Michael.
But do you know the president didn't know about this? I believe that's what
he didn't
Michael
know about
said.
The specifics of it, as far as I know. But he did know about the general arrangement that Michael would take care of things like this, like I take care of things like this for my clients.
Okay, a lot going on there, Rick. Let's start with you. The conversation that we just heard, does it change anything legally for Trump or Michael Cohen?
I don't think that part of the conversation does. And actually, the thing that was most surprising to me about that part of the conversation was that it appeared that Rudy Giuliani and whoever he was talking to in the White House was not aware of what the actual campaign finance legal threat is. So he seemed to think that the potential problem was that Trump campaign funds had been used to pay back Michael Cohen for the Stormy Daniels payment. That would be a problem, but that's never been any part of the allegations or any set of questions here. There's never been any evidence that the campaign funds were actually used to pay her off. So what's so strange about the way Giuliani framed things is that he thought he had taken off the table the big legal risk. But that question had never been one of the legal questions that had been central to this whole set of issues.
He perhaps unwittingly brought up the in-kind campaign contribution controversy. Is that?
No, I don't really think so. I think that's a distinct issue, and I don't think he understood the way in which that's a distinct issue. He thought the allegation was that campaign funds were being used for personal expenses, which is a violation of the campaign finance laws. But again, it was never alleged that the Trump campaign funds were used for this.
So does it matter whether or not Trump knew about this? Does it matter whether or not Trump repaid him? Because that's kind of where all of the attention has been focused in the media, right? Previously, Donald Trump had said, I don't know about this. I don't know where the funds came from. Michael Cohen said that he was not reimbursed. And then Rudy Giuliani goes on Sean Hannity and contradicts that. Does that change anything legally?
Well, the big threshold question here has always been whether this payment or this loan, if that's what it turns out to be, to pay off Stormy Daniels, implicates the campaign finance laws at all. That is, and this is a complicated question that hasn't been well reported in the media, but the question is, was this designed to influence the election? And it's a little bit more complicated than that, as we can talk about in a moment. But the thing that Giuliani said on that issue that seemed most damaging is when he started talking about how damaging to the campaign it would be had this been disclosed right before, you know, the closing of the election.
I think that's kind of what I was asking before, is whether or not Rudy Giuliani unwittingly brought up an opening for people to say, listen, this is actually an in-kind campaign contribution. And I'll be a media person for a second, and then you can correct me if you want to,
yes.
Rick. So George Conway tweeted out, I believe the following morning, a screenshot of a bit of federal elections law that said personal gifts and loans, if any person, including a relative or friend of the candidate, gives loans or money to the candidate, quote, for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office, the funds are not considered personal funds of the candidate, even if they're given to the candidate directly. So it goes on, but it's basically implying, okay, Giuliani just opened up a whole new can of worms. Is George Conway kind of
he's
tilting at the right direction?
He's half right.
Yeah.
But the reason this is so difficult to discuss accurately is, even if part of the motivation was campaign related, that's not the end of the story, because the relevant law says that if the money would have been provided irrespective of the campaign, even if furthering the campaign was part of the reason, then it's not campaign related.
So when he said it's helping, he didn't want to see their marriage destroyed. I think that was something else he said.
Here's one way to think about it. It would be better for everybody involved here if there were a regular practice of Michael Cohen paying off people in similar situations with President Trump. And remember that non-disclosure agreement that was signed with Stormy Daniels, one of the things that was pointed out at the time was it looked like this was a form that had been used in other contexts.
This is perhaps a practice that the president
If the argument can be sustained that even though they were sure aware that this would be helpful to the campaign, but nonetheless, Michael Cohen would have made this kind of contribution to, you know, clear up other problems that are similar, then the law is, if the money would have been paid or the contribution or the loan, irrespective of the candidacy, that's the language of the statute, then it's not covered by the campaign finance law. So that's a huge threshold issue here. Everybody assumes we are already in the world of campaign finance law, but the first question here is, are we in that world? And that's a difficult question in these cases. That was a big problem when John Edwards was prosecuted, when his wealthy donors paid hush money, if you will, to his mistress. He was ultimately prosecuted, but the jury acquitted on one charge. They were locked up on others. The government didn't prosecute him. That's a difficult issue. Now, Giuliani made the case worse. You know, he did make the case worse, but there is still this issue that really has not been much discussed, which is, even if it were campaign related, would it have been paid anyway? Because this is a practice around Donald Trump and the way he tries to protect his business and personal reputation.
And you say he made it worse because of that quote where he said, imagine if that came out on October 15th, 2016, in the middle of the debate with Hillary Clinton. Is that the part where he made it worse?
Well, of course, Giuliani wasn't there and he wasn't involved in any of this. So he's not a witness to this. So he can't make it worse unless he's repeating things that he has heard from other people about their motivations.
Okay, so this is the legal argument. Nate, you've been quiet over here, but there's a whole political...
We have an actual expert
there's
on the podcast for a change. I just feel very humiliated.
But I mean, you know, we just heard the legal angle. There's a whole other angle here, which is the politics angle and the fact that, I mean, Trump contradicted himself, right? And Giuliani also contradicted Trump. And Giuliani has also just been on a rampage. So give us your take, Nate.
I mean, I don't think Giuliani really did Trump any favors, and this morning you saw Trump trying to throw Rudy Giuliani under the bus, right? So there have been theories that, hey, you have Giuliani go out there and he's going to say crazy stuff, and I'm going to use this very geeky term, but move the Overton window, right, making it seem more acceptable that, like, hey, now if Trump does want to, like, fire Mueller or, like, kind of wage a battle against Rosenstein, then that ground is laid a little bit. I do think when people are analyzing things going on with Trump or in Trump world, they, I think, assume there's more strategy there than there really is. You know, Rudy Giuliani is a guy who's been very loyal to Trump. He's a guy who can be very loquacious, I guess, when he's speaking. Remember, Rudy Giuliani ran for president in 2008, was at one point America's mayor, was the front runner in the polls, and like kind of totally flopped as a candidate in ways that previewed the way that other kind of establishment candidates did in 2016, ironically enough. So I think he was just kind of speaking out of turn, and he obviously revealed the news about like that Trump did make this payment, and it kind of made Trump look silly. It made Sarah Huckabee Sanders look silly, potentially. You know, but I kind of like defer to Rick and other people about like how much risk does like the Stormy Daniels thing pose long term. To me, it's more like the more vectors there are for Trump to get himself in trouble, and there are more ways there are people to like scrutinize different aspects of his finances and of his relationships and Michael Cohen, whatever else, you know, one thing could lead to another. I tend not to think that he will be impeached and removed from office because of anything related to Stormy Daniels directly, but I don't know.
Can I go back and ask a question? So, Rick, you helpfully laid out for us, they haven't even crossed the threshold of, is this an FEC violation?
Well, we don't know what the facts are,
right.
But that's an important threshold,
sure,
that has to be crossed.
So,
and we have to be careful of jumping over it too quickly.
Right. Let me ask, it's my assumption or my understanding is that it is not very common to have a conviction over FEC violations. I believe there was a Missouri politician, Jeff Smith, a few years back who went to prison for this. But generally, these aren't things that people are fines are levied. But this wouldn't mean that Donald Trump would potentially go on trial. Can we clarify this for our listeners?
Well, there are areas in the campaign finance laws where the Justice Department does prosecute. There are criminal convictions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the most common situation is when someone is giving money in the name of another person. They're mm-hmm. actually hiding the true source of the money. It's also true that if you have knowing and willful violations of the campaign finance laws, that is a felony. And the more aggressively you're flaunting the campaign finance laws willfully and knowingly, the more likely it is for there to be a prosecution. But there aren't a lot of prosecutions, criminal prosecutions, for violating the campaign finance laws.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it turns out, let's focus on Michael Cohen here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it turns out that we are over that threshold and a jury would find that these were campaign contributions or campaign loans, Michael Cohen then does have a tremendous amount of legal jeopardy,
right?
Because that's a huge amount of money, way beyond. First of all, you're not allowed to make any loans as an individual to a campaign. You're allowed to contribute $2,700 per election cycle. So if it's a contribution, he's way over that. If it's a loan, it's a huge problem for him. Campaigns can borrow from banks, but not from third parties like this. And if Michael Cohen is in serious legal jeopardy, then, of course, there are all the questions about how does that put pressure on him to make a deal.
Vis-a-vis the Mueller investigation.
Yes.
So what is the worst case scenario for Trump in this situation? We can talk about the legal pressure on Michael Cohen, that Michael Cohen could eventually flip or something like that. But strictly from this payment that we've got more details on in the past 3 days, what is the worst case scenario? Like, could Trump have to testify under oath?
So one thing that seems possible already is that the president has various forms he has to disclose which provide information about loans outstanding, because that can obviously be a source of leverage actors could have over him. And Trump, in his filings, has not disclosed that there was any outstanding loan to Michael Cohen. Now, we don't know if the loan was outstanding at the time of the disclosure, because we don't know exactly when it was paid back, and it was paid back in installments. But, you know, it's possible there's already an issue about inaccurate representations on forms he's legally required to file as a public official.
So it might make people cast aspersions on filings that are already in there. They wonder, is this missing?
Is this a material omission? You're
sure.
You're required to indicate outstanding debts,
yeah,
and for good reason. It's understandable why there's a requirement like that. If it's the case that the payment is considered to be campaign related, then the campaign, when it learned of the payment, and maybe the campaign or the president didn't learn of the payment until after the election. We don't really know any of the facts here. There may have been obligations on the campaign's part to amend its forms that it files on, you know, loans and contributions and the like.
And how admissible is, like, Giuliani's statements? Does that matter, really?
you know, again, since Giuliani was not part of these transactions and he's not a direct witness,
yeah,
you know, he wasn't there when whenever discussions took place, or we don't know, was he a witness to any discussions that took place about this? But what he has said publicly so far isn't in the president's interest.
Yeah.
But I don't know how significant it is legally.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the Trump-Michael Cohen relationship? There's a little bit of a confusion, at least from my end, about is Michael Cohen on retainer? Is Trump paying him back? Can you talk a little bit about the...
Yeah, this all is quite confusing to me as well, and I think to many people. So part of what's confusing here is that according to what's been said so far, the president set up this retainer agreement at some point...
In the past, it
was not an ongoing structure that he had with Michael Cohen. He set this up at some point. Giuliani, I think, at one point said 2017. Then he suggested maybe it was 2018. And then the loan was being paid back in these $35,000 installments. Why was it being paid on an installment basis? And so at the back of my mind, you know, I have wondered a little bit. We know from the Wall Street Journal, if this is accurate, that Michael Cohen was complaining in April of 2017 that Trump hadn't paid him back. Mm-hmm. As of April 2017. At some point after that, we don't know when exactly, this retainer relationship was apparently set up and Trump started paying him back. But he dribbled it out in these $35,000 installments. We don't know over how much time. Right. Did he start being willing to pay this back because he started being afraid that Michael Cohen was under investigation?
Yeah.
Was he dribbling the payments out as a way of trying to keep leverage over Michael Cohen? These are not campaign finance issues. These go to issues about the underlying investigation,
right,
with respect to Michael Cohen.
But it's not a typical lawyer-client retainer situation.
No, it's not. And right. I still don't understand exactly how Michael Cohen is supposed to understand how much of this he uses to pay expenses,
right,
how much he uses to pay his taxes, how much is profit to him.
Right.
You know, all of that's very...
Michael Cohen's accountant
very
is confused.
I mean, the reason that we have these kind of odd details is because of Giuliani's press interviews over the past few days. From your understanding of like the way that he's framed this information, and this is to Nate Clare as well, like what was his goal and did he achieve any of his goals?
I keep on seeing press analysis that says Trump loves chaos and Giuliani sowed chaos over the past 2 days. Which I think maybe in phone conversations between Trump and Giuliani, which supposedly happened after Giuliani's initial Fox News appearances, where Trump said, hey, great job. And then later, I guess, talked to people at the White House and they said, not so great. But I'm not sure that Trump necessarily grasps what press appearances like this actually do to the political case surrounding his various intertwining scandals.
Maybe Trump or Giuliani's pitch to Trump was like, hey, I'm going to go out. I'm going to fiercely defend you, right? I'm going to first fiercely defend you in terms that everyone will understand, right, including the liberal media will understand because I have some credibility with them. I'm a New Yorker. I know how to talk to different types of people. And I'll kind of be your defender and your wingman. But, you know, but Giuliani's judgment isn't great. He doesn't really necessarily have knowledge of campaign finance law or that much else necessarily. I mean, that seems like what it was, right? He was trying to, like, audition like Stephen Miller and Scaramucci, like all these people, right, who are trying to like be the star in Trump's orbit, and they kind of wind up falling flat on their face. And there's just something about a lot of these peripheral people in Trump's orbit, they love to draw the spotlight to themselves.
Well, it wasn't a lawyerly appearance, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Like as much as you might say that someone like Michael Avenatti, who is Stormy Daniels' lawyer, as much as you might say, listen, that guy's a media whore, whatever,
he's a media whore.
Well, sure.
But I mean, he accomplishes things.
Well, maybe.
But also,
case.
I'll say that he's a little less free form than
yeah.
Giuliani is on his, like Michael Avenatti, whether or not he wants media attention, seems to come on a program with a specific goal and doesn't sort of free form it the way Giuliani seemed to.
But I think that one of the things that's probably going on here is Giuliani understood that this information was going to come out once, you know, they have the various records they do of Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
And I can picture Giuliani being able to say to the president, this is going to come out.
Let's soften
ground.
And
so it's much better if we get out in front of the story, if we disclose it, we can tell our narrative about it, And I think that probably played a significant role. And this certainly doesn't seem to me to be accidental. Mm-hmm. I think he went into that interview with the strategy that he was going to disclose this. I mean, he kind of went out of his way to introduce it into the discussion. I mean, now whether he was in command of what he said, sure, and whether he wanted to say everything he said in the way he said it, I don't know. But I think he definitely wanted to get this out there. He says he had discussed that with Trump in advance, and Trump had given him permission at some point to use his judgment when to get it out there. But part of what I wonder about is whether he thought he was getting ahead of the story because they were confused about what the campaign finance law risk was. Mm-hmm. And so, again, he thought, I'm getting out there and I'm going to diffuse it because I'm going to tell everybody no campaign funds were used for this.
Right.
And he thought, end of the case, zero risk, as he said, that's it. And I think that, unless something else is going on, I think that was confused.
So, like, are you saying basically he didn't necessarily create new problems for Trump? He also solved nothing and in the process created a kind of PR mess?
Well, the only thing he solved, if that's the way to put it, or the only thing he contributed positively, I suppose, is if they thought it was better for them to disclose this through their own voice rather than have it emerge slowly, you know, in a prosecution, mm-hmm, from Michael Cohen or from media discovering this. Yeah. He accomplished that at least.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask, so the president has recently hired some new legal representation, including Emmett Flood, who is, I guess, known in the legal world for his work on President Clinton's impeachment defense team. If you were Emmett Flood coming into Team Trump, Trump universe, you've got the Russia investigation, which is what you're ostensibly, as Emmett Flood, been hired to sort of keep your eye on. What are you worried about in this emerging Michael Cohen? Are you most worried about the legal pressures on Michael Cohen leading to him flipping for Mueller? Are you worried about, could President Trump potentially be, you know, impeached for FEC violations? I mean, what are your sort of, in the Michael Cohen realm of things and your Emmett Flood, what are you worried about?
Well, I think that the probably largest question, and I don't know if there's anything there, mm-hmm, because we, of course, aren't given access to any of these facts, but once you open up Michael Cohen's business relationships, if they are going down that route, and you look at his business relationships with Russians or Ukrainians, and whether the president was connected to any of those business transactions. I mean, we don't know anything about any of that, but I would think that the greatest risk would be, if there is anything there, getting deeply into President Trump's business affairs through Michael Cohen, and then the question about whether anything in those business affairs is legally problematic.
Right.
And so you're saying that that is the single biggest legal risk to the president right now?
Well, I'm speculating because I'm not saying that there's right evidence, mm-hmm, for that.
We love speculating here.
But yeah. I try not to do irresponsible speculation.
I know.
But, you know, it seems that President Trump's anxieties about his lawyers' business affairs being opened up has been very, very intense. And, you know, he's always been extremely sensitive about anything having to do with his business transactions being looked into by the special counsel. Of course, he hasn't released his tax returns. So, you know, that can't be looked into. So is Michael Cohen a route into any of that? And where does that lead?
Right.
Yesterday, NBC reported and then corrected their report. First, they said, you know, Michael Cohen's phone line had been tapped, and then they corrected that to say that they had logged his call so they could see which calls were placed from his phone and to where, but not the content of those calls. Do you have to get permission to make those logs? I mean, what should we take away from that report?
You typically don't, I believe. I'm not an expert in criminal law, I should say, but my understanding is that you don't have to get a warrant for that kind of information. The idea is that anything you expose to a third party, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that information anymore, and so the Fourth Amendment isn't implicated. So the reason they get information about where somebody who's under investigation has been calling, who they're contacting, you know, for example, at some key moment in the timeline, let's say that he's called 15 times in, you know, 2 hours to the lawyer Davidson in California or to somebody you don't yet know. But at a moment of crisis, there are 15 calls to this, but you want to then maybe start looking into that person and seeing what their connection to this might be. So that's how that information tends to be used. It's a way of trying to build connections and identify potential leads and witnesses.
On the ever-reliable website, Twitter.com, I saw some lawyers tweeting that sometimes pen registers are prelude to wiretaps, with the caveat that you're not a criminal legal expert. Is that – do you have any –
Oh, sure. Well, any evidence that you develop could be a prelude to give you probable cause to justify something like an application for a wiretap. But a wiretap of a lawyer, obviously, you know, is a very, very serious matter. It's a very high threshold.
Should NBC have known better, or is it easy to confuse those two terms?
A pen register and a wiretap.
Let's say that mistake is common. Whether that means that they should have known better, I've seen that mistake made before. And, you know, part of the problem in dealing with these issues, which change so rapidly from day to day, you know, even as I'm coming up here to the studio to do this, we have new tweets from the president saying that Rudy Giuliani's only been on the team for one day and, you know, he doesn't really. And, you know, it's dangerous to have to write stories in the midst of all of that. So the time pressure journalists are under, the immediacy of all of the media culture with events moving so fast is, you know, probably inevitably going to lead to various mistakes. But that's a bad one.
Right.
I mean, that's very significant. There's a big difference between wiretaps to listen into the content of phone calls and a much more routine sort of pen register.
Right. Forgive the fool's question, but
there are no, as we always are taught to say in class, even though it's not true, there are no bad questions.
The president can't be tried for a criminal, I don't know, charge while he is president, correct?
So this has not been tested.
Yeah.
Okay. So the understanding has been most academics, constitutional law experts think this, and the Office of the Legal Counsel in the Justice Department has issued opinions about this, that the president cannot be criminally prosecuted while in office. There's a separate question of whether a president can be criminally indicted while in office. And on that issue also, the Justice Department has taken the view historically that a president cannot be indicted. But that's been a more debatable issue. And in fact, Walter Dellinger, who was the Solicitor General of the United States at one time and who did support that view, has actually said he's changed his mind and he thinks sitting presidents can be indicted.
Yeah.
But not criminally prosecuted. But I would say the majority view is that presidents can't be indicted while they're in office. And Robert Mueller is to operate pursuant to the existing rules and regulations and practices of the Justice Department. They do have these Office of Legal Counsel opinions. There are two of them saying presidents can't be indicted. That's an issue that's being much debated now.
So let me ask another, just like, let's say a president murdered someone while they were in office. No, I'm serious. And would that then push, like, is there a degree of crime to which we say this is a bridge too far? We have to, you know, we have to criminally indict.
Well,
this person?
I assume that no matter what the political configuration of the House and the Senate, that if the president actually,
I wonder.
It's an extreme example, but I guess what I'm sort of trying to get at is usually we associate presidents with almost like white collar type crimes. And part of what I'm asking is if there were a more traditionally theft, battery, whatever.
Let me put it this way. Let me maybe explain the paradox, if you will, or the hard choices in both directions. So you're worried about a president who's obviously committed a crime and the House won't impeach him or the Senate won't convict him. So, you know, we have a president who's committed murder, or we think, because there's no criminal trial, but there's no impeachment either.
Right.
That seems bizarre.
Right.
Right. On the other hand, the concern has always been that to criminally convict a president is to essentially remove from office somebody who may have gotten 65 million, 63 million votes. And it's basically one prosecutor and one jury and, you know, an appellate court that reviews it perhaps, but that there's great risks in going down that path as well.
Yeah. Some of my obviously amped up question is to sort of give me entree to ask you, it seems like under the Trump presidency, there's been a lot of reckoning with these things that are either constitutionally given powers to the president. Actually, most of them are constitutionally given powers to the president. Things like the pardon power, things like the president can't be criminally indicted. Do you think that those are things that will be continue to be reckoned with after the Trump presidency? Do you think they should be? I mean, are these questions where we should say, do we endow the presidency inherently with too much power? And is it a time to reconsider whether or not there should be adjustments made?
Well, after Watergate, you know, these kinds of questions certainly took place. And there were a lot of congressional statutes that were enacted after Watergate right. as a response to that. Some of them included things like the creation of the Independent Counsel Act.
Right.
Now, that, in hindsight, many people viewed that as a mistake.
Yeah.
At least the structure, and Congress ultimately didn't renew that when it was expired automatically. But there, the War Powers Act was passed in the aftermath of Watergate to try to hem in presidential power over the use of military force. It hasn't been very effective. It's hard to predict the future, as Yogi Berra said. So we don't know how dramatic anything will or won't be. You know, certainly this presidency is putting, you know, pressure. It's creating, let's say, a stress test on a lot of the structures of American government and mm-hmm. the constitutional structures, and more importantly, the norms and the underpinnings of that whole structure. There has been talk about legislating to actually codify into law some of the norms that have been present for many generations, right. but are not actually a matter of formal law. We might have conversations about whether we should move towards a structure that many other countries have of having an attorney general's office that is more independent mm-hmm. of the president, not under so much. Now, that might not be constitutional in the American system. There'd be debates about that. But you could, depending on where all this goes, and maybe it goes nowhere, you can certainly imagine there being various conversations and various legislative proposals considered.
This is a fascinating question, and hopefully we'll be able to get you back on again to talk about it as we move forward through these investigations. But let's end on a political question, which is, we've seen over the past 3 days, first Donald Trump's lawyer contradict him, then on Twitter Donald Trump kind of contradict something that he had said in the past, which is that he didn't know where the money came from and he didn't know about the payment. At this point, do Americans already know how they feel about the truthfulness of the Trump administration, or do these kinds of lies or untruths or whatever, you know, whatever you're supposed to call them, do they matter to the American public and to the administration's health?
I mean, this is a question overall about Trump. I'm working on an article about, obviously, Trump's approval rating has been very steady. Never really much higher than 42%, never really much lower than 38%. The honesty numbers have always been poor for Trump, so one could say it's kind of baked in. You know, I mean, it is worth keeping in mind, as this article will point out, that there are presidents who seem to be in a steady state, notably Richard Nixon, although he was more popular than Trump, and then the kind of bottom fell out. And so it's like I was playing a Jenga over the weekend. You know, it's like you pull one of the Jenga tiles out and you never know, like, which tile will actually cause the ship to fall. I mean, I don't know exactly. You know, I do think that, like, as lies go, it's a fairly blatant lie that you can't really kind of, there are not that many blurry lines here, right? And also the fact that, like, it may reduce trust for Sarah Huckabee Sanders among the press and the way the press covers Trump, although I think the Times said Trump reverses position instead of lies. They're still that reluctant to call the President of the United States a liar. But, you know, it's one of the more blatant lies. I don't know. I mean, my sense, which is not worth very much, I still feel like Stormy Daniels is the second or third subplot if Trump is a TV series, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of ties in certain ways and introduces new characters, and maybe will be some deeply ironic way in which Stormy Daniels brings down the president. But, like, I tend to think that this is, like, more of a sideshow.
Yeah, but not if something happens to Cohen because of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, she could be, like, the linchpin in all of it. Yeah, I mean, Galen, I just want to bring one number up quickly before we wrap it up. But a Quinnipiac poll earlier this year showed that 63% of registered voters said that Trump isn't honest, which is quite a few people. So,
and more people than disapprove of him, right?
Right.
So there are people who
both Trump
approve
support
of him and think he's dishonest.
Which I think cuts to the heart of why Trump got the pass that he did during the campaign for so many things that would have scuttled any other presidential candidate. Sex scandals, financial scandals, you name it, Trump did it during the campaign, and he's still president. So in some ways, this is the same story, just, you know, how many years later, too? It is that Donald Trump seems to exist with different consequences than other people, and that lying, that the words that come out of his mouth, people seem to think 50-50 could be truth or lie, and it doesn't seem to matter that those odds are so even.
I mean, it seems like his two blanket defenses are, like, number one, the liberal media is lying to you, so don't trust them. And number two, hey, take me seriously but not literally, and people are taking me too literally, right? I'm not sure in this particular case either of those defenses really applies very well. Where it's stuff Trump's saying himself, there's not a lot of ambiguity around it. But still, you know, is this going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back? I mean, probably not.
Probably not. Well, I think we will leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
And Rick Pildes, constitutional law professor at NYU. Thanks a lot for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I'm happy to join you guys.
I'm Galen Druk. Ryan Nantel is in the control room. We'll be back on Monday with the regular podcast. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you soon.